Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. lawmakers are nearing an agreement on an almost $750 billion aid deal addressing the economic impact of the coronavirus. The aid package is based on $908 billion proposal unveiled by a bipartisan group of senators and will likely set aside the two major points of contention between the parties, business liability protections and state and local aid. President-elect Joe Biden has said that even if lawmakers reach an agreement on aid this month, a subsequent round of almost certainly will need to be negotiated when the new Congress is sworn in early next year. The White House said on Tuesday President Donald Trump would wait to see the specifics of the deal before signing off on it. Well, the White House announced that Vice President Mike Pence will receive the COVID-19 vaccine on Friday. There was no immediate word on when President Trump will get the vaccine. President-elect Joe Biden will be vaccinated sometime next week, according to his transition team. Meantime, the approval process of the Moderna vaccine is now in the hands of the Food and Drug Administration's Advisory Committee, which meets on Thursday. If the committee gives its approval, the FDA would grant the vaccine an emergency use authorization. The FDA also granted emergency approval of an over-the-counter COVID-19 test developed by an Australian-based healthcare technology company. The self-administered home kit returns test results within 15 to 20 minutes through a smartphone application. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo quarantining after coming in contact with someone who tested positive for the COVID-19. The State Department had said he had tested negative but was being monitored. Via remote, this is VOA News. The Inter-American Development Bank is pledging $1 billion to help Central American and Caribbean nations fight the coronavirus pandemic. The IDB will devote the money to purchasing vaccines, strengthening national institutions through strips of distribution of the shots, and building immunization capacity. Pledges, in addition to $1.2 billion, the bank already mobilized in the region to pay for testing and treatment. Wednesday's announcement comes as Latin America reports a surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths. A French court has convicted 14 people in connection with the January 2015 attacks on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine in a Jewish supermarket in Paris. The Paris trial began in September with 14 alleged associates of the jihadist terrorists facing charges of allegedly helping them carry out several attacks. The attack at the Charlie Hebdo's office was the first in a series of attacks over 3 days in January of 2015, marking the beginning of a surge of violence by the Islamic State in Europe. The Chilean Institute of Public Health has authorized the use of Pfizer's BioNTech vaccine against COVID-19, as new infections in the South American country show a slight but sustained increase. Vaccinations in Chile will be voluntary and free. Chile will prioritize health workers, public transport drivers, and armed service members, according to the National Vaccination Plan. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has also been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration here in the U.S. Well, Germany has had a record level of coronavirus deaths as it enters a harder lockdown, closing shops, schools, trying to bring down the number of new cases. Germany implemented a light lockdown at the start of November. The measure succeeded in leveling off the numbers of daily infections, but didn't bring them down, prompting stricter ones, that is. Now, in addition to closing shops and moving children to remote learning, private gatherings are now limited to two households, with a maximum of five people. Authorities in Fiji warning residents in the coastal areas to move to higher ground as a Category 5 cyclone heads toward the South Pacific nation. Tropical cyclone Yasa is expected to hit the country's two main islands late Thursday or early on Friday. Stores are closed and streets were empty in the capital. For more news, as always, please join us on our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria reopens its land borders in four regions.
It's a decision that I believe will please our countrymen and our neighbors, because it has come after the conclusion of a major work by a special committee set up by the government to examine all of the problems that led to the closure of the border.
It appears Liberian President George Weah has suffered a setback in midterm senatorial elections, helping poor nations get access to COVID-19 vaccine. Countries with advanced digital skills and safety nets are doing better during the COVID-19 pandemic. And the family of Rwanda's Paul Rusesabagina is suing Gain Jet Aviation Company for its role in his alleged kidnapping.
We have discovered proof that the invoices from Gain Jet were paid for by the government of Rwanda and President Kagame. In addition, this is Kagame's jet service.
And a former Kenya street criminal runs charity during the COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has announced the reopening of the country's land borders on four fronts. The government closed the border for security reasons, including the smuggling of drugs and weapons into Nigeria. Garba Shehu is senior special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity.
It's a decision that I believe will please our countrymen and our neighbors, because it has come after the conclusion of a major work by a special committee set up by the government to examine all of the problems that led to the closure of the border in the first instance. At this point, it is clear now that some concurrence has been reached between ourselves and our neighbors, particularly on joint patrols and a deeper cooperation to stop issues that worried us, rice smuggling, weapons smuggling, drugs, and the trafficking of younger Nigerian girls.
When the borders were first closed, Shehu, the president said the borders were being closed for security concerns. Does he feel now that the security concerns have been resolved?
We are convinced that there is enough indication that we are able to work agreements that are reassuring with our neighbors. The reopening of the borders is phased, beginning with four major points, west, north, and the east. And there is a special technical committee that will examine how well the new border posts are working, taking into consideration those concerns that you have mentioned. If all goes well, then that would obviously lead to a further reopening of all the other border points that have remained shut.
What can you tell us, Shehu, about the situation with the school boys in Katsina?
Two things. The governor of the state, who has responsibility for administration and security in his state, has been talking about two things. One, the fact that the location in which the students are held is now known, and it has been surrounded by Nigerian military forces. And two, negotiations are going on to ensure the safe release of the hostages, to ensure that no shots is fired, in order to ensure that there are no collateral damages. This is all I can tell you.
Shehu, first it was the Chibok girls, now is these 300 or so boys. Can your government assure Nigerians that they are safe?
Oh, sure they are, because the difference this one makes is that you can see the promptness with which the Buhari administration responded. There is criminality in every country of the world. The important thing is how quickly, how competently do authorities respond to such situations. We have had Dapchi girls, 100 of them, 100 plus. We went after the abductors, and this administration brought back all but one of them. Sadly, that one is still held. We're hoping she too will join her family. It's different from Chibok, when the sitting administration then did not even agree with the Nigerians that any girls had been stolen. They argued with Nigerians for 2 weeks. By then, all traces had disappeared. So we're doing our best in the given circumstance.
Thank you so much, Shehu. It's so nice to talk with you, and we appreciate it very much.
Thank you, James. I appreciate it.
Garba Shehu is the senior special assistant to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari on media and publicity. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. In Liberia, it appears President George Weah's ruling Congress for Democratic Change Party has suffered a major setback in the country's just concluded midterm senatorial elections. Rodney Sia, editor and publisher of the Front Page Africa newspaper, says preliminary results show the opposition collaborating political parties is winning big.
Well, James, the results have been a major setback for the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change of President George Manuel Weah. The opposition collaboration political parties won several seats, including the major vote-rich Montserrat County, which incumbent Senator Abraham Davros Dillon won. Incumbent Nyombli Kanga Lawrence also won in Grand Bassam County. We had victories in Bond County, where the leading contender there for the ruling party lost. There's also a victory for the former defense minister, Brani Samukai, in Lofa County, vote-rich Lofa County. So the ruling party lost all, if not all, of the major vote-rich counties.
If the results stand as they are, what would this mean in terms of governance now for President George Weah's last few years in office for his first term?
It's going to be very challenging because the Senate will now be in the hands of the opposition. As you know, the Senate came under a lot of pressure for the impeachment of Associate Justice Cabinet Jane. Most political observers believe that it was a crucial component of the results we're seeing in the Senate, because people are not happy the way he was treated. And also the Vice President and the President have been at loggerheads on a number of critical issues regarding governance. She presides over the Senate as the head, as the president of the Senate. So it's going to be interesting to see how she mustered the courage to continue doing what she's been doing over the last few months in wake of the strained relationship between she and President George Weah. So the opposition seemed to be, at least seemed to have a grasp of the Senate when the new year comes around.
Of course, Rodney, another big issue on the ballot on December 8th was that of the constitutional referendum, the issue of presidential term limit, the term limits for legislators, and that of dual citizenship. Where are we on these issues?
Well, many people are baffled because on the provisional results announced by the National Election Commission from five counties announced this week suggest a yes vote for eight of the proposition ahead of the no votes. However, the invalid votes accounts for a huge percentage of the votes counted so far. The problem has been that the counties they listed, Bong, Grand Cape Town, Maryland, River G, and Riverside, are outside Montserrat County. The referendum came under another criticism because people felt that there was not enough awareness done for the referendum. So many are now baffled that rural areas like Bong County, Grand Cape Town, Maryland, River G, and Riverside would have, you know, voted overwhelmingly for a yes on the referendum at hand. So there's a lot of controversy regarding this. The National Election Commission reported that the proposition voted on the referendum are included the reduction of the tenure of the president, of representative, the presidency, the senators, and all that. So they are saying that looking at the way things are done, and they will continue to announce the results toward the end of the week. It's going to be interesting to see how this referendum plays out. It could mean the presidency term of office will be extended, depending on how the votes turn out. But people are very concerned about NEC and how they're going to report these results, because there was very little awareness done on this issue.
Of course, Rodney, you have the political intrigue from Bapolo County, and coupled with the tradition. What's the latest from Bapolo?
Well, as of this evening, we gather that the leading candidate there was rescued by some women's group and brought to Monrovia. Voting in that county was called off on the first day, last Tuesday, December 8th, because there were some youth seized ballot boxes, and there was concern that, you know, the voting was intended to deprive the female independent candidate from contesting or from winning. She was in the lead.
That was Rodney Sia, editor and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper, speaking with us from the capital of Monrovia.
The family of Rwanda's Paul Rusesabagina is suing the aviation company GenJet for its role in his alleged kidnapping. Rusesabagina, who was portrayed in the movie Hotel Rwanda because of his humanitarian work during the Rwanda genocide, was arrested in August this year and extradited to Rwanda, where he has been jailed. Rusesabagina is charged with 13 criminal offenses for his alleged connection to the FLN, the militia group that the Rwandan government accuses of terrorism. At a news conference Wednesday, Bob Hiller, one of Rusesabagina's international lawyers, explained the purpose of the lawsuit.
It speaks volumes about the likelihood that this is 100% politically motivated, that Paul's prospects for a fair trial are way past bleak. And though we hope that we can, through this lawsuit and through the pressure of the press and other countries' governments, that we can have Paul released, given President Kagame's track record with his opponents, we're gravely concerned. And we have discovered proof that the invoices from GenJet were paid for by the government of Rwanda and President Kagame. In addition, this is Kagame's jet service. He uses this jet almost exclusively when he flies around the world, including to the United States. We've tracked his tail number through investigations, and, you know, he sometimes comes to NBA games in the United States and enjoys the freedom of our country, while at the same time behaving like a strongman dictator inside of Rwanda.
Hillard also explained why the lawsuit was filed in federal court in San Antonio, Texas.
Paul Rusesabagina is a permanent U.S. resident. He has rights and protections under the United States government. He was the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, you know, the highest civil medal that can be awarded to a civilian in the United States by President Bush. He's been honored by our country and speaks often around our country about the work that he has done on human rights. Now, for him to be kidnapped and tortured, having been inside the United States, calls out for our country, our Justice Department, to speak up, to stand up, and to reach out to the Rwandan government and say, this will not stand. This egregious conduct towards a man who protected others from the same type of conduct his whole life needs to be addressed by our government.
That was Bob Hiller, one of Rusesabagina's international lawyers, speaking at a news conference on Wednesday. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 17. In this year's Global Competitiveness Report, the World Economic Forum measures the ability of countries to weather and recover from the devastation caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Because of the pandemic and the inability to collect necessary data, country rankings in the World Economic Forum's competitiveness report have been suspended. Instead, it examines the factors that help economies better able to manage and recover from the pandemic. The report notes the deep economic recession triggered by the infection continues to have profound economic and social consequences. While no country has emerged unscathed, some are more resilient than others. World Economic Forum Managing Director Sadia Zahidi says countries with advanced digital skills have been more successful at keeping their economies running during the pandemic.
Countries that have a greater level of digitization across their economies and that have been able to switch relatively rapidly to remote work, those happen to be the countries that fared slightly better, and in particular their populations, because of being able to maintain their jobs, fared slightly better.
The report cites the Netherlands, New Zealand, Switzerland, Estonia, and the United States as countries that have performed well on this measure. Authors of the report find countries with strong social safety nets and robust healthcare systems also have managed to withstand the worst effects of the pandemic. Zahidi says a number of international institutions advise governments to use stimulus packages to support their economies and workers during this difficult period. At the same time, she says governments should start moving to a slightly more dynamic phase in preparing for the post-pandemic period.
That doesn't mean that governments will not need to continue to do some investment, continue to provide some support. It may not be short-term furlough schemes, but it may instead be longer-term support for safety nets that allow workers to move out of their current roles, to get some income support, to be able to retrain, to reskill, and then move on to another future role.
Zahidi says recovery from the coronavirus for lower income or highly indebted countries will be more difficult than for the advanced economies. She says an international collaboration agreement is needed to support these countries in the short term so they can move forward. She adds they will need support from the international community for some time to recover from the ruinous impact upon their economies by COVID-19, the illness triggered by the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An initiative known as COVAX, set up by the World Health Organization to give poorer nations access to COVID-19 vaccines, is short on cash, with only a fraction of the 2 billion doses it hopes to buy over the next year. Some experts say the chances that coronavirus shots will be shared fairly between rich nations and the rest are fading fast, as most face a second wave of the pandemic. For more, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Kit Elder, senior vaccine policy advisor for the group Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign in New York.
COVID-19 might be new. The issues surrounding access to these vaccines that are now coming rapidly, but those issues are not new. I mean, these are issues that we see time and time again that MSF sees in the medical field in terms of access to medicines, diagnostics, or vaccines because of the way the current research and development and biomedical innovation system is set up, where we allow pharmaceutical companies to be the ones that really get to dictate who gets access to these medical tools, at what prices, and at what time frame. What we typically see in the field of vaccines and other medical tools, where the wealthiest countries get access to vaccines first, and then the poorest countries much further down the line with a significant time lag get access to vaccines.
What are the options or alternatives open to either countries or citizens of these poorer countries?
I mean, in terms of options for them getting access to COVID-19 vaccines, I think the very sobering reality is that sadly, they don't have many options. Their governments don't represent an attractive customer to pharmaceutical corporations that are looking to make money off of COVID-19 vaccines. The poorest countries of the world are not the countries that pharmaceutical corporations are running to try and engage in advance purchase arrangements with. So the people in these countries, really, the risk is that they're left behind. Again, a situation that we see just regularly in the work that MSF does and the work that we try to do to access medical tools for the populations that we serve. So, I mean, that's the risk in terms of people. In terms of what these governments can do, what we need is governments of developing countries to be using their voice. One, to be using their voice to call foul on the way things are happening right now with access to COVID-19 vaccines. They need to speak up. They need to talk about these inequities. They need to talk about their concerns with the Gavi-led COVAX facility, that it might not be delivering vaccines to them anytime soon. They need to talk about what the world should be doing to put in check this power imbalance with pharmaceutical corporations having just so much power and seemingly the people having so little and truly being at the mercy of the system. And governments as well need to use the tools that they have available to safeguard the public's health. Right now, there's a series of very important initiatives happening at global institutions, including what's happening right now at the World Trade Organization. At the WTO in Geneva, the governments of South Africa and India have spearheaded an initiative to ask for a very exceptional waiver of intellectual property because of the severity of this global pandemic. South Africa and India and now have garnered co-sponsors from other governments and much support from about 100 governments around the world are talking about the need to do things differently in terms of treatment of intellectual property and the monopolies that intellectual property awards to pharmaceutical companies because of the severity of this pandemic. So governments want to be able to waive certain intellectual property protections because of this public health crisis so that we can scale up quickly availability of medicines, diagnostics, and vaccines.
That was VOA's Chinua Du Ofor speaking with Kate Elder, Senior Vaccines Policy Advisor for Doctors Without Borders Access Campaign in New York. Former Kenyan street criminal Torres Omol managed to turn his life around and start a charity helping people where he grew up, the slums of Nairobi. COVID-19 has hit these communities hard with unemployment, making day-to-day life a struggle. To prevent children from turning to street crime as he once did, Omol does regular handouts of food aid to help them get by, as Brad Elmendorf reports from Nairobi.
At Nairobi's Dondora dumping site, the stench of garbage is strong and the ground is soft with waste. A group of people, including children, dig through trash while scavenger marabou storks look for food scraps, and smoke drifts up from small fires. 30-year-old Torres Omol often comes here to talk to street children who survive by recycling garbage. The hardship of life on the streets and facing predators and abuse pushes many of them to drugs and crime. Omol knows his life well, as he was doing the same at the age of 16, after his parents died.
We used to snatch bags and also get some clothes. When you wash your clothes and we put them somewhere, we want to look smart, but we don't want to buy clothes. So we will tame you and get your clothes.
Omol says he left the dumping site after police caught his friend and beat him severely. Through the help of his aunt, he went back to school and finished college. But Omol couldn't forget the street children left behind. So he started gathering donations of clothes for the children, and in 2013 formed the charity Mnara Mutani, which quickly grew.
Right now we have supported over 30,000 people. And we have over 5,000 donors who we don't know. They only bring their clothes oftenly.
With COVID-19 worsening the economic squeeze in Nairobi slums, Omol this year expanded to distributing food and sanitary pads. A lack of sanitary pads among poor families means girls often miss school for a few days each month. On a courtyard next to the dumping site, young girls line up to get a free package. 30-year-old Carol Obonio recycles garbage at the dumping site, but she wants a better life for her 11-year-old son, Bernard. Wearing a leather cap, at first glance, she could be mistaken for a fashion model, except she's covered in mud. Obonio says that Omol helped her get Bernard off the street. Obonio says that Omol taught her how to keep a child away from the dump site to scavenge. She feels that the dump site is not good for children. Even before the pandemic, the United Nations Environment Program in 2018 said 3,000 families were living off recycling from the Dondora dumping site. Former garbage recycler Omol is doing his part to get Kenyan children off the street and prevent the suffering, abuse, and crime that he lived through. Ruth Elmendorf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Thursday, December 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.